Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, April 26th. My pleasure to be with you, the feast day of Our Lady of Good Counsel, one of the beautiful Marian feast days in which we recall that through the gift of the Lord Jesus Christ, we have a spiritual mother, the mother of God, Mary, entrusted to all believers there at the cross. And we have an advocate and a helper and someone praying for us and assisting us, pointing us toward her son. So Our Lady of Good Counsel, pray for us. Next hour, we're going to talk to my good friend Chelsea Zimmerman. Chelsea, who holds forth at the blog ReflectionsOfAParalytic.com. She's also the editor-in-chief of the Catholic Lane blog. She's going to be in. We're going to be talking about this reality of assisted suicide, which evidently they're getting ready to pass a law in Canada, making it much easier for doctors to participate in killing people. And she has a blog post up, "Dear Doc, Please Don't Kill Me." It's actually inspired by a friend, Mark Pickup, who's written a letter to his physician, not tongue-in-cheek, actually instructing him never to allow or cause him to be euthanized, even if he asks for it. Of course, Chelsea, a monthly guest or so, she looks at bioethical issues a good bit and blogs about them. And she herself, of course, it's deeply personal because she herself had a spinal cord injury when she was in high school a good number of years ago. And therefore, even though there are occasions in which there's bioethical research out there that could potentially show promise to healing spinal cord disease, or at least the hoped for potential, for example, embryonic stem cell research, she steadfastly refuses anything because, I mean, that those treatments or that research, because, as you know, a principle of Catholic moral teaching is that the ends, no matter how noble, can never justify an immoral means and destroying human life, even if it's even at its most nascent, is in fact an immoral end. Maybe we should say especially at its most nascent and vulnerable. So we'll have Chelsea on during the second hour, and certainly welcome your calls anytime during the program today. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post any thoughts on Facebook or on Twitter. I'll give you the question of the day in the second segment. We'll also talk about William Shakespeare and connections that he may have to Catholicism. On the anniversary of his death this past Saturday, 400 years since the Bard of Avon died. Also, why boredom at Mass could be an asset. You've been waiting for it to come around, and here's some hope on that front. And also, pregnancy and a mother's brain. Of course, we'll also spin the Dollar Catechism wheel. We'll look back in history, and we'll make our "What Were You Thinking?" nominees, all that and more in the program. Again, if you want to call or text, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, and we would love to hear from you. I was looking at the readings for today, the first reading taken from the book of Acts. We've been in this process during the Easter season, of course, of reading during the first readings the Acts of the Apostles. It's interesting because We, for most of the liturgical year, during the Mass readings, the first reading is typically taken from the Old Testament. We see God's work throughout salvation history, pointing to, leading to, foreshadowing, being consummated, of course, in Jesus Christ and his Paschal mystery. But during the Easter season, rather than simply look at the history before the ministry of Christ, we look at the ministry after the ministry of Christ, or an extension of, we should say, the ministry of Christ, in which we, human beings who are part of Christ's mystical body, continue his work in the world. As I've said, just as the Gospels could be called the Acts of Jesus, we have then the Acts of the Apostles, and they're meant to be a continuation of. This is why Jesus ascended to the Father and why the Holy Spirit came to dwell in each believer and to compel them to be witnesses in a increasingly outward-directed, spiraling circle from Jerusalem to Judea, to Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. It's really a symmetrical logic to it, really, when you think about God's original creation. When he created human beings, male and female in his image, he told them to be fruitful and multiply, and he intended for them to basically spread out, or to permeate the created order, bringing glory to God. Of course, after the fall, much changed, but then when Jesus came, the new creation, breathing upon his apostles, just as the Lord Creator had breathed into the first man the breath of life, Jesus breathing the power of his new creation into human beings. And again, his mission for them when the Spirit came would be that they would be fertile and multiply and permeate the world and bring about the benevolent dominion of God. And so the book of Acts, very much the story of that spreading of this good virus, the Christian faith, with the goal that all of humanity, even creation itself, which longs and groans awaiting redemption. And so we have this passage from Acts chapter 14. Paul and Barnabas have been there preaching, doing acts of power, miracles, healings. And the crowd so enamored with them that, in fact, Paul and Barnabas were so deeply offended because they thought Paul and Barnabas themselves must be some kind of gods. Well, it all was going well until, as this passage says today, in those days some Jews from Antioch and Iconium arrived and won over the crowds. They stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing that he was dead. But when the disciples gathered around him, he got up and entered the city. On the following day, he left with Barnabas for Derbe. So he left. After they had proclaimed the good news to that city and made a considerable number of disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch. Yeah, that maybe could cue the what were you thinking, award music for that? I mean, really? You go back to the very place where they stoned you and left you for dead? What were you thinking? This is, by the way, not uncommon if you look over the history of Christianity. Talked about this before. If you look at the North American martyrs, for example, somebody like St. Isaac Jogues or St. Jean de Brébeuf, there were occasions in which they escaped their Native American captors. Even, I can't remember if it was Jogues or de Brébeuf who had his thumb and forefinger cut off because they'd noticed that when he celebrated the Mass, one of those black robe Jesuits, as they called him, that he used his thumb and forefinger to hold aloft the host. They cut off the thumb and forefinger to keep him, allegedly, from saying the Mass. He was able to escape, made his way back to France, received a special dispensation to be able to celebrate Mass without a thumb and forefinger, and yet chose to go back again right into the maw of opposition. There's always an interesting balance when you think about, when you read about martyrdom and suffering and the persecution of Christians, not only throughout history, but of course, even in these early days in the book of Acts, is that there's nothing unchristian of seeking to avoid persecution. And I mean seeking to avoid by denying one's faith, but one needn't have a death wish. Thus, Paul and Barnabas left this area of Lystra, Antioch and Iconium, where they had suffered when the heat began to rise. And yet, they didn't stay away. They came back. And part of that, I think, is the process of discernment that every person who suffers in the faith has to go through. There's a great film a number of years ago called Of Gods and Men. You really ought to see a true story about some Trappist monks in Albania back in the 1990s, that North African country. They lived in peace, really harmony with their local Muslim villagers until some more fundamentalist jihadists began to rise up, and it became apparent that the life of the monks in their monastery was in increasing danger, that perhaps it would only be a matter of time before they would find themselves on the blunt end of the violence of these jihadists, and to watch their own discernment process, even their interior debates about whether to stay or whether to leave, thought that there would be any shame in leaving, and yet they felt called as shepherds of a flock to remain in loving service even to their Muslim neighbors. I'll let you see the film to see what they decide. You could probably guess, but maybe get a taste of that here. Paul and Barnabas leave after this horrible act of violence, and yet they go back, strengthening the spirits of the disciples, exhorting them to persevere in the faith. I would say their words had some authenticity. They were practicing what they preached. They said, "It is necessary for us to undergo many hardships to enter the kingdom of God." Then they appointed presbyters or priests for them in each church, and with prayer and fasting commended them to the Lord in whom they had put their faith. Then they traveled through Pisidia and reached Pamphylia. They kept going on from there, continuing to rotate out, transformed as they were by the Holy Spirit and by their encounter with the living Jesus. Not even suffering could dissuade them, merely empowered them. We'll be back in just a minute with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show on this Tuesday, April 26th, feast day of Our Lady of Good Counsel. A little reading on that, Our Lady of Good Counsel, a title given to the Blessed Virgin Mary, actually part of those listed in the Litany of Loreto, if you've ever prayed that. It's named after a painting said to be miraculous, now located in the Augustinian Church at Genizano near Rome, Italy. Only measures 40 by 45 centimeters. The image is a fresco on a thin layer of plaster, no thicker than an eggshell. Of course, it depicts the Blessed Mother embracing her infant son. And according to tradition, in the year 1467, in the 15th century, during the festivities for the Feast of St. Mark, which of course was yesterday, April 25th, the town folk suddenly heard exquisite music. A mysterious cloud was then said to have descended and obliterated an unfinished wall of the Paris church. In front of the populace, the cloud dissipated and a beautiful fresco appeared of the Virgin Mary and the Christ child. It's widely believed it had been miraculously transported from a church in Scutari, Albania. Picture of Our Lady was first called La Madonna del Paradiso. Our Lady of Good Counsel. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you've got a comment or a question today. 573-4-BREAD-4. Love to hear from you. My question of the day, there's an article in the National Catholic Register from Matt Archbold. Matt Archbold, who in the past I've really enjoyed reading his stuff. He and his brother Pat Archbold, they have a site called Creative Minority Report. For some reason lately, I've got a little more soured on Matt Archbold. I thought he had a little bit more of a too Catholic for the Pope edge at times in his writing since the papacy of Francis. This is, I think, a thought-provoking article he has in the National Catholic Register. As he begins it, his title is, "Why is the U.S. suicide rate skyrocketing?" This was not even something I was aware of till I saw his article. According to the New York Times, the suicide rate for middle-aged women ages 45 to 64 jumped by 63% over the period of the study, while it rose by 43% for men in that age range. Now, this study only covered a span of 15 years. The overall suicide rate rose by 24%. from 1999 to 2014, according to the National Center for Health Statistics, which released the study on Friday. The increases were so widespread, they lifted the nation's suicide rate to 13 per 100,000 people, the highest since 1986, and the rate rose by 2% a year starting in 2006, double the annual rise in the earlier period of the study. In fact, in 2014, there were over 42,000 people who died from suicide, while in 1999, there were 29,000 people who died from suicide. So you went from 29,000 plus, 15 years later, 42,000 plus. As Archbold points out, many people see this study and point instantly to our dire economy. But he says that he doesn't think things are that simple because we've had economic downturns before. He offers several theories. Of course, none of us know for sure. One thing he mentions is the distance we seem to have from each other these days. It's like an epidemic of aloneness that is contagious. He says we don't know our neighbors anymore. We just don't connect. Instead, we have television, we have our devices, and so forth. He said it used to be, too, that politicians were dirty, but they weren't in our lives 24-7. Newscasts make us conscious and even weary of national problems, so we end up as a people bonded by what divides us. Our national conversation is an argument. We ignore our own neighborhoods as a result, for example. He said it's so much easier to think macro about humanity than it is to actually pick up a phone and see how someone else is doing, or walk down the street and talk to the crabby old couple. Easier to skip your neighbor's daughter's wedding and just send a gift, and so forth. He also talks about what he thinks may be the counterintuitive consequence of the ridiculous self-esteem movement. He says since the 60s, we've told kids they're great, and we've all gotten, as a result, multiple generations of narcissists. Maybe it's time we stopped giving out participation trophies. Maybe it's time we kept score in games. Maybe it's time for teachers to use those psyche-shattering red pens to grade tests. Generations of young people have grown up to be shocked that the other little despots they're surrounded by won't bend their knees to them. Yeah, I mean, maybe that second part of his argument to me feels a little flimsier, because it seems like authentic narcissists would have a hard time ending their own life. Maybe that's just me. So my question is, Archbold has his theories. I mean, it's apparent that this has been a suicide rate increase that cannot be ignored. Do you have a theory as to why suicide rates seem to be skyrocketing? Maybe you agree with Archbold. Maybe you think it's isolation. Maybe you think it's our distance from each other in this high-tech world. But what do you think are the reasons that suicide rates may be increasing? Maybe it's something you've struggled with yourself. You'd feel comfortable talking about it. That'd be fine. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. There have been times in my life, quite honestly, that it hasn't so much been the shock to me that people would be tempted to take their own life. It would be rather the surprise that more people haven't, simply because, I mean, life is not easy. And if you don't have this cohesive, animating understanding of life's purpose and meaning, I mean, even if you're a person of faith, life can be difficult, whether it's the trials or the sufferings that we endure, whether it's the disillusionment that sometimes comes when we see those perhaps whom we respect who then are proven to be frauds. Sometimes the almost seemingly pointlessness of it all and all these sorts of things. If you didn't have faith, I think it'd be so easy to fall into despair, as I said, even tough for the believer. And sometimes I think the person who is tempted to despair is not really the mentally ill one. They're actually the perhaps the one most willing to look at the starkness of a life apart from a transcendent love. So if you've got a thought or comment on that, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Checkered sports stuff. I saw where yesterday a judge upheld Tom Brady's original four-game suspension. Now looks like, better late than never. He is going to be serving out that four-game Deflategate suspension at the beginning of this next coming year. You got to wonder about that. Is that going to hold up? Will that sort of push Brady toward retirement? I don't know. Of course, according to Bill Barnwell, ESPN.com, the Patriots are primed to survive the Brady suspension. Maybe this will answer the whole which came first, Belichick or Brady question. Did Belichick make Brady or Brady make Belichick? I have to think this is just going to fire up Mr. Coach Hoodie all the more to have a strategy. And if he can navigate maybe a 2-2 record out of it or even a 3-1 record of it before Brady comes back, watch out, NFL. I don't want to make the guy mad. I don't want the Patriots to win, so I don't want to make them mad. That's just my viewpoint. Of course, the news, big news coming out of Stephen Curry being out for 2 weeks for the Golden State Warriors with a sprained MCL in his knee. All of a sudden, this 73-9 record and the defeat of the Bulls record, their championship drive now looking a little dicier, and we'll see what 2 weeks really means if they can, their next opponent in the playoffs, Clippers or Blazers, if they could stretch their series out, then maybe Curry will only have to miss a couple of games when that series begins. So we'll see how that all plays out. All right, let's get on to our What Were You Thinking nominees for the day. We've got a couple. How about this guy from Wichita Falls? Robbed same store 3 times in about a month. There's an old saying, you know, go to the well once too often. A Wichita Falls man accused of robbing a convenience store Wednesday has confessed to robbing the same store 2 other occasions within about a month. He's now facing 3 charges of aggravated robbery. Really? I mean, okay. This like shooting fish in a barrel when it comes to certain criminals, I guess you could say. How about this? Beyonce fans who were upset in her new album that she seemed to hint at Jay-Z's infidelity with a woman called Becky, who evidently a woman by the name of Rachel Roy, who was married to Jay-Z's former business partner and manager, seems to have admitted that she's the one who perhaps was the source of Beyonce's anger. But Beyonce's fans made a big mistake in going after her online. I'll have to explain that when we come back from the break, as well as give you our winner for the What Were You Thinking Award. You're going to like this one. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. At the bottom of the hour here on the Mike Allen Show on this April 26th, this song numero uno 40 years ago today, Bellamy Brothers, Let Your Love Flow Like a Mountain Stream. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to chime in with a comment or a question. We'll be talking with Chelsea Zimmerman in the second hour via Skype. Chelsea, who holds forth at the blog reflectionsofaparalytic.com, will be talking about the rise, not only in the practice, but in the acceptance of suicide, physician-assisted suicide in particular. But for my question of the day, I'm taking it out more broadly. Suicide in general, with a staggering increase from 1999 to 2014 over a 15-year period, our suicide rate in this country going up over 40%. And Matt Archbold, whose article I linked on the show's Facebook page, along with the question of the day, he has some theories, including our isolation from each other, as well as the misguided, what he calls the misguided self-esteem movement. Do you have your own theories of why people seem more prone to despair, more prone to causing their own death than before? You've got a thought on that, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. All right, back to the What Were You Thinking Awards. I mentioned in this second nominee that evidently Beyonce and her new album, Lemonade, which may shock you, I've not yet rushed out to purchase, but in one of her tracks, evidently, she addresses a cheating lover saying, "He only wants me when I'm not here. He better call Becky with the good hair," which, of course, has left Beyonce's fans, the Beehive, as they're so called, wondering, who is Becky? Well, as I said, it turns out Rachel Roy, who was married to Jay-Z's former business partner and manager back in the late 2000s, quickly put a target on her own back. Maybe seemingly a thinly veiled comment that made it seem to indicate that she's the Becky in question. However, the Beehive, Beyonce's fan base, evidently thought Rachel Roy was a typo, that the offending party, the other woman, was really Rachel Ray. And so, Rachel Ray, you know, the very popular chef. People went to her Instagram account and left nasty comments on her photo of a pulled beef chili sandwich. Rachel Ray, the homewrecker. Come on, people. That seems like an odd pairing, doesn't it? Anyway. But our winner, we're going to go to this school in Austin, Texas. Now, we're in a period in which we want to try to erase any sort of historical memory of people that do not measure up to our current vision of tolerance and acceptance. And so the school in Texas, named the Robert E. Lee Elementary School, decided they were going to change its name. And they were seeking suggestions from the public, which is always a danger. And evidently among some of the nominations for the renaming of the Austin School include the Adolf Hitler School for Friendship and Tolerance. Makes me think of the play The Producers, you know, Springtime for Hitler in Germany. Drew Brees Elementary, Bruce Lee Elementary, and Schoolie McSchoolface, but maybe the best, the John Cena Elementary. Ladies and gentlemen, John Cena! The top suggestion right now, though, is Donald J. Trump Elementary with 45 nominations. Surely they didn't commit themselves to going with the most popular. There were also a few other names that made the suggestion list, like Willie Nelson, Harriet Tubman, and Kanye West for the elementary school. Come on, why not John Cena? Thoroughly American. Others say Abraham Lincoln Elementary. Trying to see if there's some others. They've given you the full list here of the nominees online. Oh, man, there's a whole bunch. How they're going to cull through all these. Ayn Rand, that's a good one. Let's see, the B-Movie Elementary. I mean, that wasn't even a good movie. A Black Lives Matter Elementary, Communist Elementary. Oh, people having fun with this, aren't they? Let's see. There got to be some other ones. Oh, Dwayne Johnson. Dwayne the Rock Johnson, I guess, Elementary. Anyway, so keep that in mind when you put it out for the public. A Flava Flav Elementary, that's good. Anyway, you'll find lots of people having fun with it. Anyway, so 573-4BREAD-4 if you've got a comment or a question, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I guess it is a good publicity thing, right? Well, speaking of Donald J. Trump, the leading vote getter in the elementary naming sweepstakes, Donald J. Trump, I guess, not impressed by the so-called John Kasich and Ted Cruz alliance meant to keep him from the 1,237 delegates needed to wrap up the GOP nomination before the convention. In fact, called it pathetic and so forth, and just showing their own desperation and how much they have to lose. He even kind of reverted back to old Donald Trump mode and called out Ted Kasich for his disgusting eating habits. The fact that he was taking too big of a bite of pancake or something. I have to say, though, when it comes to criticizing his opponents plotting together against him, coordinating their efforts in such a way that they know they can't get the required delegates, but they're going to choose their areas where they have the greatest chance of success to try to hamstring Trump's attempts. I guess I can see his point on how at a certain level it does seem a little desperate and pathetic. It is what it is. They know that this is really probably their only chance that they've got to stop the Donald Trump train from getting the nomination. So there's a bunch of primaries today. Let me run through them here, really quickly. You've got Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. And then Indiana a week from today, which is a big one as well. We'll probably have a much, much, much clearer picture this time next week on the likelihood of Donald Trump being able to secure the necessary delegates in order to kind of wrap up the nomination before a so-called contested convention. All right, let's run on here to the looking back in history on this day over the years, April 26th throughout the ages.
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Who are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
Don't know much about history.
All right, so on this day in 1564... William Shakespeare, English playwright and poet, was baptized in Stratford-upon-Avon, Warwickshire, in England. He, of course, lived to 1616. In fact, this last Saturday was the 400th anniversary of his death. We'll talk next segment about William Shakespeare and potentially his ties to Catholicism. A lot of scholarship now starting to point in that direction. In 1607, on this date, an expedition of English colonists went ashore at Cape Henry, Virginia, to establish the first permanent English settlement in the Western Hemisphere. Permanent, the word there, of course, you had the lost colony. And English, another key word, because St. Augustine, Florida, of course, predates Jamestown. 1865, on this day, John Wilkes Booth, the assassin of President Lincoln, surrounded and killed by federal troops near Bowling Green, Virginia. Happy birthday to Carol Burnett on this day, 83 years old. I grew up cutting my teeth watching the Carol Burnett variety show. Carol Burnett, Tim Conway, they're great. Mr. Tudball and Mrs. Weekends skit. Of course, Harvey Korman. I always loved how he and Tim Conway would make him barely able to contain his laughter. Great show. On this day in 1941, so 75 years ago, a tradition begins. The first organ at a baseball game there at Wrigley Field. Only that organist could have lived to see how good the Cubs are this year. Kevin James born on this day in 1965, so must be a good birthday for comedians. On this day, 50 years ago, Red Auerbach retired as the Boston Celtics coach after winning 9 NBA titles as a coach. On this day, 30 years ago, the world's worst nuclear accident occurred at the Chernobyl plant in the Soviet Union. An explosion and fire in the number 4 reactor sent radioactivity into the atmosphere. At least 31 Soviets died immediately. Of course, that's located now in Ukraine. My good friend Alan Alday, who's on the program every few weeks, spent some time over there in Ukraine, not far from the Chernobyl accident. In 1989, the actress comedian Lucille Ball died at the age of 77. Probably Carol Burnett's only competition among funny redheads in the history of television. And then in 1983, the NFL draft, John Elway was the first pick by the Baltimore Colts. Of course, he would never play a down for the Colts. But the Colts were redeemed, I guess. Back in 2012, they selected Andrew Luck as the number one quarterback. He's doing pretty well. We'll be back in just a minute. We'll talk about William Shakespeare and Catholicism. What's the connection? Give us a call, 573-4BREAD-4. This is the Mike Allen Show.
I'm coming home, I've done my time. Now I've got to know what is and isn't mine. If you receive my letter telling you I'd soon be free, then you'll know just what to do if you still want me. If you still want me. Oh, tie yellow ribbon around the old oak tree. It's been 3 long years. Do you still want me? If I don't see a ribbon around the old oak tree, I'll stay on the bus, forget about us, put the blame on me. If I don't see a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree.
For 14 minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. This song, Tony Orlando and Dawn, number one back in 1973. I can remember tooling around in my mom's green metallic Chevy Impala listening to this tune back in the day. What a great ending to, right? 100 yellow ribbons around the old oak tree. 573-4BREAD-4. If you want to chime in, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. And the beautiful part of that story, of course, is after being imprisoned, knowing you have a place to be, people who have not given up on you, people who love you. That's unfortunately what it seems like a lot of people have lost sight of. Maybe that's part of the reason behind our skyrocketing suicide rate as a country. People, for whatever reason, find themselves in a place where they feel devoid of authentic meaning and devoid of authentic love. What's your theory behind it? Why in this world, which seems to have so many good things, why are an increasing number of people being driven to despair and a sense of pointlessness about it all? Be interested in your thoughts on that. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Reminded of that quote of St. John Paul II, I think it was from his letter, Redemptor Hominis, in which he said something along the lines of, let me find it exactly, I think I've almost got it pulled. Here we go. This is from paragraph 10. Man cannot live without love. He remains a being that is incomprehensible for himself. His life is senseless if love is not revealed to him, if he does not encounter love, if he does not experience it and make it his own, if he does not participate intimately in it. Devoid of love, life really loses any meaning or purpose. One of the things that I think is beautiful at the heart of our Christian understanding of the world is why we were made as human beings. We were not made out of God's need. God, who is an eternal communion of persons, God wasn't lonely, needed a friend. We were created really out of the overflow, out of the generosity of his love. God, he created us out of love, and we were created for love. Love is the whole reason we exist, and it's the whole purpose toward which we are oriented. As St. John Paul II says, a man who tries to live or a person who lives without love is a being incomprehensible for himself. When I use that verse, I've used that verse before talking with teens. In the midst of a talk, usually I'm giving on St. John Paul II's Theology of the Body. I say, if you doubt that, imagine just for a moment that you came to a place where you were firmly convinced within yourself that nobody loved you. And not even your own family, your parents, those who we think sort of are required to love us. What a desolate place that would be, because we were made for love. And the good news is, of course, we are never void of love, because we are always infinitely loved by the one whose opinion matters more than anyone. And yet there are those, obviously, who come to a place where they feel like this world would be better off without them, and that they would be better off without life. What do you think brings them to that point? 573-4-BREAD-4. If you want to chime in, if you've got a comment, 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. We, of course, talk about the website Crux Now on a regular basis, edited by John Allen, recently broke away from the Boston Globe. The Boston Globe no longer funding it. Now they've reached a partnership with the Knights of Columbus. It really is an excellent on-site resource for all things Catholic, and a wide variety of topics, and oftentimes a wide variety of perspectives across the Catholic spectrum, from, to use these unfortunate political terms, across the spectrum from more liberal, let's say, to more conservative. But this article here, was Shakespeare actually a secret Catholic? Now, this used to be sort of a strong minority opinion among a few, and there were those Shakespeare scholars who almost mocked Catholics who suggested that Shakespeare had strong Catholic sympathies, or in fact was a Catholic, what we might say, a recusant, somebody who, in the midst of the turmoil, the religious turmoil after the fallout of Henry VIII's decision to cut ties with Rome and all that entailed between going back and forth between Queen Mary to Queen Elizabeth and so forth, that Shakespeare had was a secret Catholic. It used to be laughed about. Now there's more and more evidence that there could be something to it. According to this story from the Catholic News Agency by Anne Schneibel, of course, April 23rd, this past Saturday, marked the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. The playwright, poet, and actor, widely considered to be the most influential literary figure in the English language. Yet there's one mystery, as it says, which continues to elude scholars even to this day. What exactly was Shakespeare's relationship with the Catholic Church? And could he have been a secret Catholic forced to conceal his true religious identity in an era of persecution? At the time of Shakespeare's writing, Ms. Schneibel points out, Britain was in a period of religious upheaval. Its people were still caught in the crossfires of the English Reformation that had begun decades earlier when Henry VIII declared himself head of the Church of England. Now, Shakespeare, like many of his contemporaries, outwardly followed the state-imposed religion since it was illegal at that time. Illegal, mind you, to practice as a Catholic. However, scholars say he nonetheless maintained strong sympathies with the Church of Rome. And they point to Shakespeare's writings. They clearly point to somebody who was not just saturated in Catholicism, but occasionally argued for it. This from Claire Asquith, who is a scholar and author of Shadow Play, The Hidden Beliefs and Coded Politics of William Shakespeare. She says he was definitely putting the Catholic point of view to an intellectual audience, she said. So what's an example? Well, consider the Catholicism in Shakespeare's Hamlet, a play which scholars say captures the sense of conflict experienced by the population as the country transitioned to the Church of England. Shakespeare's play, here's the thing, you know, I'm no expert in this field by any means, but I've read people like Hilaire Belloc, who was a Catholic who wrote extensively on these sorts of things, and said that the idea, for example, You saw this in his book, Characters of the Reformation. The idea that is common is that there was this great public groundswell to break ties with Rome. And all the kings and leaders of England did was recognize that and make the appropriate decisions. But the truth is, the country of England was thoroughly Catholic. It was the leaders who abandoned their ties to the Catholic faith. And gradually, over time, first by force and later through persuasion, got the majority of the English people to forget their Catholic roots. But this tension present during a play like Hamlet, just like we said, a few decades removed from Henry VIII's fateful decision. This is what Asquith said, the Shakespeare scholar. She said, Shakespeare's play Hamlet dramatizes the position of all these people in England, torn apart like Hamlet, having to play a part like Hamlet, pretend they were irresponsible, perhaps mad, and yet having to make a decision about what to do about this. She said the conflict is particularly represented through the ghost of Hamlet's father in Act One. She says, everything about the ghost is the old order, which has been displaced by a brand new Tudor state, with the monarch as the head of the church, which was still highly, highly contentious, she said. I think scarcely anyone in England went along with it at that point. They did it superficially, of course, out of self-interest, and it gradually did produce a creeping secularism. She says, Hamlet's mother, who has married his uncle very soon after the king's death, represents the England that has given into the new order reluctantly while urging Hamlet to go along with it. On the other hand, he has his father saying, no, Hamlet, stand against it. You must do something about it. Now, there's another, Joseph Pierce, author of Through Shakespeare's Eyes, Seeing the Catholic Presence in the Plays, takes this conflict in Hamlet a step further by saying the play is speaking out against England's persecution of Catholic priests. The play illustrates the venting of Shakespeare's spleen against the spy network in England, which had led to many a Catholic priest being arrested, tortured, and martyred. The ghost of Hamlet's father is clearly a Catholic in purgatory who exposes the wickedness of the usurping Machiavellian king Claudius. Pierce reiterates that more people at that time had Catholic sympathies than is commonly believed. This is pretty fascinating. There was an article in The Atlantic about this a couple of years ago as well. And we'll get into this more in the second hour, along with my conversation with Chelsea Zimmerman, who holds forth at reflectionsofaparalytic.com. We'll be talking about physician-assisted suicide. This is The Mike Allen Show, back with a new hour.